Hello, and welcome to the Tech Disruptors podcast hosted by Bloomberg Intelligence. In this podcast series, we speak with C-level company executives and management teams about their views on disruption and how it's driving their decision-making and strategy. My name is Woojin Ho, analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence, and I'm pleased to have back to the podcast Nutanix CEO, Rajiv Ramaswamy. Hi, Rajiv. Welcome back to the podcast.
Great to be here again, Woojin.
Great. And look, we last had Rajiv on the podcast to talk about the value of hyperconverged infrastructure and the company's turnaround. Now, a lot has happened since that episode. The company hosted an analyst day outlining a path to growth, to growing sales at a 15% compounded rate from $1.9 billion in fiscal 2023 to $3.3 billion-ish by 2027, as well as growing annual recurring revenue or ARR to 20% rate to $3.2 billion. Now, importantly, it's shifting its strategic focus from stability and business transformation to scaling up the business, aiming to grow free cash flow to $700 million to $900 million. Now, the business opportunity seems to have wildly changed since we had Nutanix in July. Now, it's actually tilting in its favor. Broadcom's VMware acquisition may expedite the displacement opportunities, and Cisco chose to wave the white flag in its own HCI product by partnering with Nutanix for FlexPod. Now, we don't make stock recommendations here at BI, but it really has resonated well in the stock price. This has translated to 130% boost to the stock price when we aired our last episode. So, Rajiv, let's reacquaint the audience with Nutanix, right? You're an IT infrastructure software company that competes against traditional hardware tech bellwethers. What is the company's value proposition over traditional hardware stack?
Yes, in very simple terms, many companies out there in their data center deploy traditional stacks of compute, storage, and networking. They buy separate hardware for each of these. They have separate teams running each of these. And what we do is simplify that architecture dramatically. We reduce costs, we automate things, we build a software-defined cloud for them. So instead of running all of these things separately, you can buy commodity servers from a vendor of any vendor and run our software on it. And we integrate and provide the management of compute, storage, networking, all put together using software, on top of which companies can run whatever applications and workloads that they are running. And as when they do this, this is what we call hyperconverged. And when they do this, they get significant total cost of ownership benefits, including the ability to manage large estates with very small teams, not requiring a lot of pre-training, and could be more fresh out of school type of people. So simplification of the infrastructure, that's part one of the value proposition. Part two is extending that into the public clouds. And so the same architecture, the same platform also extends into bare metal on AWS and Azure today and other clouds over time. And so with that, now customers get to operate in what we call a hybrid multi-cloud environment, where they can now choose to have their applications and data running wherever they want them to be, manage them in exactly the same way with one team, and be able to also move stuff around without being locked in. So that's the fundamental value proposition.
Okay. I think you're being humble here, right? Because I think you were pioneers of this hyperconverged and hybrid multi-cloud, right? And that's been the core thesis for quite some time now. And when it first was introduced, it wasn't really broadly accepted. I think the debate back then was whether or not hybrid multi-cloud is an opportunity. I think that debate is over, right? We're starting to see HPE, they changed their storage and GreenLake business, and now they're calling it a hybrid cloud. IBM seems to be all in this hybrid cloud thesis. Now, where are the corporates in terms of the hybrid cloud conversations, and how has that evolved since post-COVID?
Yeah, I think it's changed dramatically. If you talk to CIOs 4 or 5 years ago, most of them would probably say, I'm going to go to the public cloud eventually with everything.
Right.
And what's the dialogue has changed significantly. Today, what they've seen is the folks who have gone to the public cloud, of course, it's the easy button, right? In the sense that it's a very attractive proposition initially because you can spin up your workloads or build applications, get them to run very easily. But what happens is as you start scaling, the cost goes up a lot. So that's one big factor. And people are finding that steady state workloads can be run much, much more effectively and cost effectively in their own data centers. A great recent example of this was a white paper that the Twitter or X put out. After Elon took them over, there was a significant focus on cost cutting. And what they did was they repatriated a bunch of their workloads from the public cloud onto their own data centers, and they claimed like 60% type cost reduction numbers in their white paper. So that's one driver. The other drivers are around data sovereignty, data locality. Not everything can be just put out in the public cloud. There's data issues. There is security concerns. There's regulatory concerns. There's a notion of portability also in terms of where you want to, you want the flexibility to be able to port and run workloads where you'd like to. So all of this, I think, has created this new realization that the world is going to be hybrid and multi-cloud. And that's where most CIOs are today.
Okay, so it sounds as if the conversations have gotten easier over the past couple of years in terms of the hyperconverged and as well as hypercloud.
That is absolutely that's a fair statement. Yes.
Okay. So, but why is so Dell has a multi-cloud solution. HPE has GreenLake, and it seems like they have a cobbled together multi-cloud solution. Why is hyperconverged the right approach for multi-cloud?
Yeah, and first of all, I think when we look at multi-cloud, you need to have a software layer, right? A full software stack that extends across clouds. And I'd say at this point, the players who have that to me today are, of course, we have it, VMware has it, okay? And some of the public cloud providers have also gone the other way, right? Which is they've taken their public cloud offerings and made it on-prem. You've got AWS with Outpost, for example, Azure with Azure Stack. But those are not multi-cloud. That's their cloud and an on-prem solution. But it comes down to the software, and it's really the folks who have the software that really provide that capability. So when I look at the alternatives in terms of hybrid cloud, it really is, you know, from a software perspective, it's us, it's VMware, it's the public cloud providers. There are other people. In fact, we go to market through HPE. HPE GreenLake includes the Nutanix solution as part of it, right? If customers choose to. So and HPE, what they do is, they, of course, have GreenLake, which is really taking all their hardware and offering that as a subscription model on-prem. And on top of that, they can layer in software stacks such as ours.
Okay. All right. So this isn't only, I want to shift to IT budgets before we delve into the technology opportunities here. It seems as if IT budgets have been in this two-year malaise. First, it was the supply chain bottlenecks. Then it followed up with the capacity glut, and customers right now seem to be cautious with their IT budgets. Where are we now in terms of IT spending, and what are your customers telling you?
Yeah, I think we see the demand environment as being quite stable, but not out of the woods fully, in the sense that our customers are spending, and they are spending, but making sure there's good TCO benefit for anything they do. And they're also scrutinizing what they spend money on. So in the past, we used to see projects being approved by, say, the VP of IT, and now it goes up to the CFO, for example, to make sure that it's really a legitimate, worthwhile spend for them. But they haven't stopped spending, because for all these companies, modernization of both their infrastructure and application stack is a critical initiative, because they're all going digital. This is the future of their business. And so from that perspective, they are continuing to spend.
Okay. All right, so they are continuing to spend. TCO is the focus, but you know, when during the COVID period, I think everyone was excited about this term, digital transformation, and really driving that digital transformation. And quite frankly, HCI is one of those technologies that's supposed to help drive that. What happened to that digital transformation that was supposed to kickstart spending? And has that sentiment shifted, or did they start to dial it back? Is that still on the forefront of CIOs out there?
Oh, I think that is absolutely on the forefront. Digital transformation is what's driving all the underlying spend on infrastructure these days and their application modernization. So those are the two things that we see as a result of the digital transformation priorities for customers. And so it's very much there. It's still a top of mind CIO issue, because it's an enabler for the business. Right, companies, as they go, you know, they are going digital because that's really their future. And you know, I like to say that every company these days is becoming a software company in some ways or the other, right? And Yeah, you're a bank, you're a software company doing loans, effectively, for example. So that's, I think, and that's what we see everywhere. And that's very much, I think, still fundamental and core to their business. I think they're just being cautious about getting the ROI on what they spend.
All right, so let's shift gears to the opportunity here, right? And I want to level set the audience. Broadcom recently closed the acquisition of VMware, which is a direct competitor of yours. And it seems the deal is causing a lot of, I want to say not only disruption, a lot of angst in the VMware customer base. And you know, the investor thesis is that this is going to create a lot of displacement opportunities for Nutanix. And quite frankly, I can't think of a better person to have on the show, given your background. I'm looking at the Bloomberg here. Prior to you becoming the CEO of Nutanix, you were at VMware. Prior to that, you were at Broadcom, and prior to that, you were at Cisco. So you have a unique lens here. But can you summarize the opportunity for the audience in terms of size and scope?
Yeah, I think first of all, I think from a size and scope, you know, we've already summarized this at Investor Day. We have a TAM of about 76 billion, of which, and that includes, you know, software-defined compute, storage, networking, all of that in that TAM, right? And this, the way I would think about this particular VMware situation is that it gives us an opportunity to share faster than we probably normally have into that TAM. Right, that's the way I would see this as a potential acceleration. And of course, look, the thing that you have to keep in mind here is VMware, of course, historically has been a tech leader, but with the acquisition now, it's going to change the relationship the customers have with the company because Broadcom's focus is, of course, on running this thing as efficiently as possible, getting maximizing, in fact, doubling the EBITDA within 3 years, as they publicly stated. And so what that means for customers, of course, is typically, you know, price increases, potentially less support as cost cutting comes into play. And that's what's creating and disruption in the channel partner community. This is what's creating the angst that you refer to. Now, for us, what this means is a multi-year opportunity to gain share into the TAM that we talked about here. Now, I would just, though, also say that we look at this as a long-term multi-year opportunity because multiple factors. First, many customers who knew the Broadcom playbook signed 3 to 5 year enterprise agreements with VMware before the deal was closed. So they bought themselves some time to go do anything different. That's number one. Number two, I do believe that Nutanix is the simplest and easiest alternative for VMware customers looking for another alternative, looking to reduce their risk or dependence. But at the same time, any migration, infrastructure migration also, for example, a migration from VMware legacy architectures to a hyperconverged from Nutanix also needs to be timed potentially with hardware refresh cycles and hardware buying, whether it's servers or storage, right? So it's the VMware agreements on one side and it's their hardware, you know, depreciation cycles on the other side. Those have to come into play together in terms of like a trigger point for when they would actually do the migration. So that also takes time. And the third is that, you know, not everybody is going to do wholesale migrations. Many people might adopt a dual vendor strategy and they might bring us in, for example, for a portion of the business. And over time, you know, we have a record of expanding on our initial land with all these customers. So this is why we characterize this as a long-term multi-year opportunity.
Okay. All right. So let's talk about some of these changes that VMware introduced. It seems as if they've gone from a la carte basis, right, this catalog sheet of VMware products, and now they're only selling bundle products of four big silos. Now they're only subscription only. They're subscription only.
Right.
No longer perpetual. That actually works in your favor because you're a subscription-based product as
Right.
well. And then you mentioned the price hikes. I've heard anywhere to the tune of 3 to 4 times, right? And to your point, it looks like customers who understood the playbook probably re-up their renewals prior to the deal closing on the older price sheets. One, from your conversations with customers, right? Because I'm sure it's a long-term dialogue. Where is the opportunity here for Nutanix? Is it those who have stayed on this perpetual licensing scheme, those who are on a subscription scheme, or and clearly those who haven't made the switch at all and looking for better pricing. So how do you feel the sudden void?
First of all, I think the most VMware customers, based on my understanding, are still on perpetual licenses.
Okay.
Not on subscription. So for all of them, it is a shift to subscription for them. I would sort of perhaps classify this differentiate between large customers, the very large customers, and the smaller customers. So if you look at what Broadcom has said, they're focused on taking those top 2,000 customers of VMware direct, no channel partners anymore involved in that piece. And if you look at those very large customers, they tend to have more complex environments. They will probably be slower to migrate. And many of them will employ dual vendor strategies. Today, if you look at the global 2,000 customers, the top 2,000 companies in the world, about half of them, about 1,000, are existing Nutanix customers. And for those, we see an opportunity to potentially expand beyond our original footprint. Because we are, even if we have them as customers, today, we have a portion of their estate. We don't have a huge portion of their, there's still ample room for expansion. So a good example of this is a global 2000 bank in Asia Pac that we talked about in our last quarter, not this quarter, where they've had a dual vendor strategy with both us and them and for the last many years. And what they did recently was do an expansion deal with us, with us alone. So what that means is that over time, we will get more and more of that estate. So that's the large customers. And that's true whether we have them today as customers or whether they are, whether they are white space for us and that there'll be new customers for us, hopefully. On the smaller customers, I think there's potentially more room for them to do a wholesale migration. And I'll give you an example of one that's public. Pediatrics, this is the healthcare system, a recent case study that they just put out. It's public. Healthcare system, they were considering a migration and modernization of their infrastructure, typical, away from VMware to us for the last many years. In fact, we've been engaged with them for 3-4 years, and they would describe this as a gradual phenomenon, but then accelerated. After the deal closed with Broadcom, they decided they were going to make the move, and they were completely out, fully migrated within 90 days. So okay. You see the dynamic there, right? So smaller customers, if they put their minds to it and they decide to pull the trigger, certainly. And we have done a lot of work in terms of automating migrations. We've been doing this for a long time with automated migration tools for the simpler environments. For very complex environments, we'll, of course, require some professional services because they've done a lot of their integrations on top of the stack. So the landscape varies depending on the customer, the kind of deployments that they've had.
Got it. So you were talking about services, especially for large customers. And also let's talk about the smaller customers, right? VMware, Broadcom decided to go direct to certain amount of customers and also changing the partnership terms. From my math, it looks like they cut out roughly 10,000 channel partners out of their 28,000 now to 18,000. Does that potentially expand the channel partner program for you guys and a bigger opportunity that we didn't expect at the analyst day in September?
Yeah, I think we've certainly seen a higher level of engagement with many channel partners looking to do more with us and build our practices. By the way, there was a recent example, not a channel partner, but an SI, Wipro today, who announced that they're building an expanded practice with Nutanix that just came out today, for example. But there are more partners looking to engage with us, and there are partners who are also VMware partners, right? Many of our partners, current partners, are also VMware partners, and some of them are looking, especially the ones that are losing out the top 2,000 customers, right? That's revenue loss for the partners. They're looking to re-up with us in terms of going forward. So certainly, I think this disruption in the channel partner community is helpful. We've also increased the level of incentives that we provide as part of our channel Elevate program, we call it. This is our channel program. In terms of providing our channel partners more incentives to bring us new customers. And perhaps on that front, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention. So we've got channel partners, programs aimed at helping our channel partners. We've also got programs help at easing migration to the end customer as well, to help them tide over financially while they're doing a migration. from us. And so those are both, I think, they go hand in hand.
Okay, well, I mean, for the sake of the audience, the press release is out. You can mention the partner, the SI. It's Wipro. So, you know, from my understanding with the Wipro is that they'll only go after work with software vendors only if there's a need. And clearly, Wipro is looking for you to fill some sort of void that VMware created. That was the sense I received when I read the press release.
Indeed, indeed. I mean, they've been a good SI partner with us for many years, and this is again an expansion of that relationship.
Got it. Here's a big one that no one. It looks like Dell ripped up their partnership with VMware as well, with an 8K filing. I still think that Dell will sell their VxRail product, but does that also open up a potential partnership opportunity with you?
Yeah, I think Dell, in the very early days of Nutanix, was a very strong go-to-market partner for Nutanix. But then after Dell bought EMC and VMware, of course, that relationship changed. And where the relationship is today is that Dell's hardware is fully certified with Nutanix software,
Yep.
but we don't do any kind of joint selling. So we sell our software and the customer can choose to run it on certified Dell hardware. So that's where the relationship is at this point. It remains to be seen where that could go in the future, depending on what they do with Broadcom or not do with Broadcom. So nothing more for me to say at this point.
Two more topics on Broadcom VMware. First of all, as part of some of the licensing changes, it seems as if they killed the free version of their OS, right? I think it's called ESXi,
Yes.
right? That is pretty much, I would say, angering or creating a lot of frustration to the VMware user group community. I understand Acropolis, you have a free version or a lab version of
Yes.
Acropolis. I mean, does that change potentially change the long-term dynamic on where you'll fit in the VM world and the hyperconverged world?
Yeah, and I think again, I think this is just again one more thing in that overall picture, right? It's again hard to carve out each of the individual effects, but certainly, right? I mean, if you look at the community, I think this is an opportunity for a lot of VMware people who build their careers on VMware. I mean users, right? Users who build
Right.
their careers understanding VMware to say, look, here's an alternative for them to learn their skills, adapt to the new world. And those who come to Nutanix and start using us, and of course we make it easy for them to do that, will realize that this is actually very easy, very intuitive, easy to use. And the learning curve is not steep at all. And we are here to help them in the long term. So this is again just one more thing, right, that Broadcom has done that just, I think, from a user community perspective, certainly helps Nutanix.
And the last big topic on the Broadcom VMware, they're finally selling their end user compute business to KKR, to private equity. I want to talk quickly about the opportunity, or ask you about the opportunity, but also Citrix was bought up by Vista,
Yes.
right? In addition to the opportunity, why do you think the private equities guys are interested in this particular business? And what do they know that us common investors may not know on the remote desktop EUC side of the world?
Yeah, I think that by the way, it's the VMware business has two components to it. There's a remote desktop, EUC, and
Right.
there's also the mobile device management piece, which you call Workspace ONE. The remote desktop, I think you've probably being at Bloomberg, you know this, right? I mean, it's a very important element within a lot of financial services companies, right? I mean, and it's pretty sticky. It's there for the long term. So it's a business that's going to continue. And if you look at the players, you've got Citrix on the one side, now you've got the VMware Horizon offering on the other side. And those will continue to be there for a while. And I think the private equity folks are looking at this as an opportunity for them to run these businesses more efficiently and get more value and create it's a value creation opportunity. That's why they're investing in those. And it's a market with not too many players, significant players, right? You've got on the one side, you've got Citrix, you've got VMware, and you've got, of course, the public cloud providers such as Microsoft in particular, and then AWS a little less. But so it's a market that's fairly disciplined from a competitive perspective, and so they see an opportunity for them to create value. Now, for us at Nutanix, Virtual desktops has been, it was sort of the anchor workload for us in the early days of the company, and it continues to be an anchor workload. Today, it's about 15 to 20% of the workloads that run on our platform. We run a lot of other mission critical workloads, databases, security, ERP systems, everything runs on our platform. But that workload is still an anchor workload for us. And so we've had historically a long partnership with Citrix. And interestingly, I think this proposed divestiture of Horizon allows us potentially to actually have a partnership with this new co, right, that will be owned by private equity, KKR.
Oh, interesting. Okay. All right, so let's shift gears. The other big news since our last meeting here was your Cisco partnership, right? Another potential opportunity to change the growth trajectory of the company. Could you outline the opportunity here?
Yes, I think Cisco, of course, a lot of respect there. I worked for many years at Cisco back in the day, and great company with a huge enterprise footprint, a huge enterprise selling force, and of course, a leader in networking. Now, in the past, Cisco had their own product in the space, one that they acquired many years ago. It was called HyperFlex.
Yep.
And we've been talking to them for a few years now. And eventually, I think we both came to the realization that all of us could win if Cisco were to sell the Nutanix offering. Win for Nutanix, of course, win for Cisco, and a win for Cisco's customers. And that's fundamentally because our offering clearly is a market leader. And so Cisco decided to embrace our offering and stop their own internal product. And so now they're reselling our product. They've end of life announced the end of life for their own internal solution. So we look at this and say, okay, this is a good growth opportunity for us. With Cisco sellers now selling the Nutanix offering in the market, it potentially opens, again, doors at companies that look at Cisco as a traditional partner and were probably not as open to bringing in Nutanix by itself. So again, I look at this as an expansion of our routes to market. And it's very early days for us. This is the second quarter that we are in with Cisco in terms of product in the market. A lot of interest from Cisco customers, Cisco partners, and Cisco itself.
Okay, so I'm going to push back a little bit in terms of the Cisco opportunity. I think it's fantastic, but they're really not a big player on the server and storage.
Correct. So that's the other side of the coin, right? So if you look at Cisco, clearly huge player in networking.
Yep.
Small player in compute and small player in HyperFlex.
Right.
And so this is why, we've said that the Cisco opportunity for us is, small this year, but it'll be growing next year. Now, the only thing I will just say is, while Cisco's share is small, they are quite effective, and we will be also helping them with the sell, right? They do have the potential to bring us customers, and we do have the potential to go work together with them to go win those customers over. But you're right, their share in compute is small, their share in hyperconverged was very small, for sure. But again, I think what's small for a company of Cisco size could be reasonably meaningful for a company of our size.
Yeah,
we're a $1 billion company in terms of revenue. So,
I mean, look, one of the beauties of this partnership that you have with Cisco is now you have access to their enterprise sales force.
Yes,
right. So you have the benefit of that scale. I know that it's predominantly a Cisco focused deal, but now with the Cisco sales force, are you able to pursue the VMware opportunities going forward?
Oh yeah, I think we will pursue that opportunity to every route to market that we have through our channel partners, through our sellers engaging with customers, and of course through Cisco, because they see the same opportunities. At the end, we're all talking to the same set of customers.
Right.
And it's like, so this opportunity comes through every route that we have.
I want to shift gears to the third opportunity that ballooned over the last 6 to 9 months, and that's your GPT in a box,
mm-hmm.
right? Still fairly early, but I will tell you one thing. When we last talked to you in July, AI was a cloud-only thing, but quite frankly, it's been a lot stronger than anyone has imagined. It seems much of the strength in AI is largely the cloud build-out today.
Yes.
Where do you think the enterprise customers are in their AI journeys?
Yeah, I think the most enterprise customers are pretty early in their journeys.
Mm-hmm.
The ones we talk to, they it's a top of mind topic for all of them. It's I would say they're largely experimenting with Gen AI, especially. By the way, just to be clear, we should differentiate Gen AI from regular AI, right? So you know, things like machine learning workloads, computer vision, this stuff has been there for a long time and they've been using it. But generative AI, it's relatively new. And they're all experimenting with it. They're trying to make sure that they can get good return on their investments as well. I mean, like with AI, like with any other new technology, there's a massive hype cycle and early beneficiaries. And then there's sort of a, perhaps a, let's call it a coming to reality in terms of where can I deliver real value, and then a steady growth beyond that. And I think we're getting to that phase where enterprise companies are looking to see where can I benefit from this? How do I use it? And can I make sure that I get the return on investment for the money that I'm going to spend on my computer infrastructure and everything I need to go train these models and bring those applications to production? So the so they're still in their early stages. Now, I think from our vantage point of view, the reason we did GPT in a box is because AI, like every other application, is also a hybrid application.
Yep.
Because you know, the simple way I like to say it is AI needs to run where the data is. Data is not going to go to where the AI is. AI needs to go where the data is. And so the data is everywhere. Data, some of the data is, of course, in the public cloud. And a lot of the initial focus today has been in terms of training these large language models on generically available data in the public cloud. But a lot of enterprise data is not in the public cloud. It's sitting in the data centers. And a lot of it is being generated even at the edges. If you're, for example, a manufacturing shop, your machinery is generating a lot of data that needs to be analyzed, and you need to do inferencing on that. And so if you sort of shift to looking at fine-tuning these generic models on your data and then running inference wherever the data is, and perhaps sometimes closer to the edge, that then makes it apparent that AI is also going to be hybrid. And so GPT in a box is exactly that. It's allowing companies to easily run their AI applications, but generative AI applications, on top of a full stack that's already ready to go.
Okay, so you actually answered my next two questions, right? Where does it reside? And is more training or inference? It's clear multi-cloud works here, right? Especially when you talk about data sovereignty, you will need some sort of multi-cloud type of solution. And then after you train your models into the, on the cloud for, per se, you want to bring inference here. How do you think, how long do you think this opportunity will present itself? Or how long will it be before this opportunity really starts coming to you or coming to the rest of the enterprise?
Yeah, I think it's very early days. It's probably a couple of years out, I would say, in terms of real volume scale deployments. I mean, I'll give you an example of us as a company itself as a customer. We ourselves are experimenting with generative AI. Multiple use cases, right? So the most obvious use cases are around customer support, where what we are looking at is as we get incoming support calls using a generative AI engine to go search through all the data that we have in terms of our design documents, in terms of our knowledge base articles, and to see if we can help our support engineers get quicker resolution to these issues. So it's more than a chatbot, right? Chatbot's the obvious one, but beyond the chat, it really is, this is about document search, analysis, and summarization to see if we can actually identify root causes. Then we are experimenting with a number of different LLMs, trying to see how compact we can make it, trying to assess the accuracy of what we generate. Can we trust it? This is the other thing that we have to be careful about, right? For enterprise applications, you need to be able to trust the results that you're getting from any of these LLM models. And so the accuracy, and so today we our initial use case is to use that as a support assistant to our support engineers. And so that's the stage we are in, right? We haven't rolled this out into production yet. We are doing experiments. We're checking to see the accuracy. And perhaps sometime over the next year, we'll start to roll it out as a production feature internally. And that's probably where most companies are.
Okay. I mean, not in your example, but when we go from trials and pilots, how big does this potentially scale? Are we talking about tenfold, multiple fold? I'm just curious in terms of the sales opportunity. Because if it's a small trial, right, it could probably $100,000, $200,000 project, but these could be millions if they really start moving down in that direction.
Yeah, I think, again, I think that remains to be seen, Ujin. I mean, it's just hard for me to speculate how big this could get. It's certainly depending on the complexity of the workload. There's a number of ISVs who are out there building turnkey applications for everything from things like mortgage processing and automating mortgage processing to credit card applications,
Yep.
all kinds of stuff out there. So some of those could get pretty big. And if those are also run on-prem, I think it could get significant. But I'd be speculating at this point. I mean, I think right now what I'll say is for us, it's very small. It's certainly not material. And but it's an exciting future opportunity that we will. It's also evolving very rapidly. If you think about even where this was, it was all about training in the public cloud. Now there's talk about multiple different architectures that are different from classic just GPU-only architectures for inferencing and in doing inferencing at the edge. So it's a rapidly evolving field, and time will tell, I think. But something that has to, it has the potential to be quite significant, but for us, it's very small right now.
Okay, let's shift gears to financials. I have a sense that VMware and Cisco and even AI is proving to be bigger than we had anticipated, right? Fiscal 2025 consensus has Nutanix sales growing 17%, which is faster than 15% for fiscal 24. Do you think the street fully appreciates the opportunities ahead of you?
Yeah, I think we are quite comfortable with the targets we laid out at our Investor Day, right? That's the most long-term targets that we've laid out, right? You alluded to those at the beginning of the session. 20% ARR growth, going towards the Rule of 40. We will continue to invest for long-term, profitable, sustainable growth. Now, we haven't provided an update to those numbers yet. We will provide an update to FY25 on our Q4 earnings call, right? So that's when we'll guide the full year at that point. But we are very comfortable with this. I think investors are starting to understand the story in terms of the opportunity in front of us. Yeah, hybrid cloud, the whole VMware thing in terms of what's happening and what that could mean for us, the Cisco partnership. And I think GenAI, I would say, is much more long-term, right? I think we should factor a lot of that in upfront at this point. So these, I think, are the fundamental opportunities that are driving our growth. And we are committed to investing for that growth, but also continuing to drive leverage to the bottom line.
All right. So it's funny that you mentioned that, right? Given that all of these bigger opportunities, let's just say Cisco as well and VMware, and quite frankly, you've done a fantastic job in cost discipline. Do you think that you have you need to invest more to really pursue those opportunities, given that it is bigger?
Yeah, we are investing more, Woojin. You're right. Over the last 3 years, we've been managing our costs very carefully. And if you look at our OpEx over the last few years, it's been largely trending flat. This year, you will see a tick up, and you will see another tick up next year. Now, I would say we're not going, we are being still disciplined about how much we invest, but make no mistake, we are investing because we do believe there is growth. And we want to capture on the growth, both in terms of investments in R&D as well as investments in sales. So that's really what the focus is then. And so I think for us, we have to strike that balance. We want to continue to invest in the future for the future growth. We will invest. We are taking up our OpEx. At the same time, we want to make sure we are driving the top line growth and increasing profitability to the bottom line.
I think in this, I guess, muted IT environment, investors are rewarding companies that are growing and also growing profitably. So you've actually struck a very good balance here.
Thank you, Woojin.
So, I mean, that's all the questions I have. Are there any final takeaways about Nutanix for the audience?
No, I think Nutanix has come a long way here. We are a hybrid multi-cloud company, well suited for companies managing their applications and data across multiple environments. I think we've demonstrated a track record of now disciplined execution, 7 consecutive quarters of beat and raise, and we look forward to continuing to work with our investors and customers as we build this out for the long term in terms of sustainable, profitable growth.
Yeah, perfect. Well, I think we'll wrap here. Thanks, Rajiv, for sharing your thoughts. And thanks for being on the show.
No, thank you very much, Woojin, for having me.
Right. And thank you, everyone, for joining us. We have a great lineup of future disruptors, similar to Nutanix. So hit the subscribe button to keep up to date with the Tech Disruptors podcast so you don't miss an episode. With that, goodbye.